Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover Psalms chapter 45, which I will entitle Your Throne, O God, is Forever. The heading of the psalm, given in our translations, depending on how you translate it, is this. The NASB translates it this way: For the director of music to the tune of lilies, with quotation marks around lilies, of the sons of Korah, a maskil, a wedding song. The Holman Christian Study Bible translates the heading this way: To the choir master, according to lilies, capital L, no quotation marks, a maskil of the sons of Korah, a love song. Well, here's some of the differences. The NASB assumes that lilies is a tune, that lilies is a song, and this Psalm 45 is to be sung to the same tune as lilies. The Holman Christian Study Bible is not as precise on that point. It just says, according to lilies, whatever lilies is. Maskil is not capitalized in the NASB. In the Holman Christian Study Bible, maskil is capitalized, which doesn't make sense to me. If maskil is some kind of a literary or musical term, I don't know why you would capitalize it. And the NASB says that this psalm is a wedding song, whereas the Holman Christian Bible says that this psalm is a love song. Well, that's close, but the Holman Christian Study Bible translation leaves open the possibility that the psalm is between a fiancé and his betrothed. But as we get into the contents of this psalm, it seems to me like it's a wedding song to me. Now, in the heading, we have either to the tune of lilies or according to lilies. What does lilies mean? Well, Jameson Fawcett Brown suggests that it could be a descriptive term describing an instrument that is shaped like a lily. But the other option is that it's to be sung to a tune, a song that was called Lilies, which makes more sense to me. All of this is total, utter speculation that will not advance your spiritual life one centimeter. The psalm is written by, or it's of, the sons of Korah. We assume that means it was written by. Could be it was written for them, but we'll assume it's written by them. The sons of Korah were a choir of Levites that King David had appointed to serve in the temple worship. They were descendants of that famous Korah, of Korah's rebellion fame, number 16. The earth opened up, they were swallowed. Their descendants, however, kept the family name alive in something positive as being in charge of the temple worship. Now, so far, starting in Psalm 42, which is book 2 of the 5 books that make up the entire collection of Psalms, starting in book 2, Psalms 42, all the Psalms so far have been of the sons of Korah, if we assume quite reasonably that Psalms 43 should be a part of Psalms 42, because in many Hebrew manuscripts, Psalms 42 and 43 constitute one psalm. So I'll keep a running count as we go through, as we determine how many psalms are written by the sons of Korah. So we start now in verse 1. The psalmist says, My heart overflows with a good theme. Clark says this means his heart is boiling, or his heart bubbles up with a good theme, which is a little bit more descriptive than overflows. The psalmist addresses his verses to the king. Now, we're going to see in this psalm that there's a whole lot of controversy as to who this king is, capitalized in the NASB, the king. Well, the first question we ask is, if we assume that the king is an earthly ruler, why would we have a poem in the Bible to honor an earthly ruler? Now, the NIV Study Bible says the reason is because the psalm contained additional layers of meaning in addition to the idea of an earthly ruler. The NIV Study Bible says the poem was composed originally to celebrate the marriage of the king of Israel, but later the psalm took on messianic significance. The king of Israel, who was anointed, came to represent the Messiah, of course, because Messiah means anointed one. Well, that's reasonable. In other words, basically the NIV Study Bible is saying this psalm is a type. The king is a type of the true Messiah, Jesus. Well, we're going to see that a lot of people disagree with the NIV Study Bible on that point. So we now turn to the question of who was this earthly ruler being honored in this psalm? Well, we're going to see that there are two options to take here as we go through this psalm. I'll refer to both options all the way through. The first option is that the king is a real-life human Jewish king. Now, Jameson Fawcett Brown says that several Jewish kings have been suggested by the commentators over the years, from King Solomon even to wicked Ahab. That's option number one, a Jewish king. Option number two is that the psalmist is making a direct reference to the Messiah, In other words, consciously writing about the Messiah, not even meaning an earthly king. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown takes that view, and those commentators say this, but to none of them, none of the earthly kings, can the terms here used be shown to apply. And it is hardly probable that any mere nuptial song, especially of a heathen king, would be permitted a place in the sacred songs of the Jews. The advocates for any other than the messianic interpretation have generally silenced each other in succession. What Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown mean there is that those who advocate for an earthly Jewish king don't advocate for the same earthly Jewish king, and thus silence each other as they fight for their particular Jewish king. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown continues, while the application of the most rigorous rules of a fair system of interpretation has but strengthened the evidences in its favor. In other words, the favor of the view that the psalmist is referring directly to the Messiah and not to an earthly king. And Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, to back up their interpretation, quotes the author of Hebrews, saying that this quotation by Hebrews of Psalms 45, verses 6 through 7, should be conclusive of the argument and show that the psalmist is referring to the Messiah. Hebrews 1, 8, and 9 says this, but of the Son, he says, God says, actually he says is in italics, it's not in the original text, so let me just read it this way, but of the Son, comma, your throne, O God, is forever and ever, and the righteous scepter is the scepter of his kingdom. You have loved righteousness and hated lawlessness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of gladness above your companions. Now, we haven't gotten there yet, but when we get to Psalms 45, verses 6 through 7, we will see that Hebrews has quoted verses 6 and 7 directly. But now, does that prove that the psalmist was referring directly to the Messiah? No, I wouldn't say that's conclusive, because authors in the New Testament often took passages in the Old Testament and made messianic references out of them, even when the Old Testament passage obviously wasn't messianic. It was just some detail, and then the New Testament writer says, see there, this applies to Jesus, which is fine, they're inspired writers, but that doesn't mean the psalmist meant that when he wrote it. And so, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown's case, while persuasive, is not dispositive. The NIV Study Bible could be right, that the psalmist is referring to an earthly ruler, but with typological implications. So now, moving back to where we were in Psalms 45, verse 1, the psalmist says, I address my verses to the king. We've discussed the options on who that king might be. And then at the end of verse 1, the psalmist says, my tongue is the pen of a ready writer. The analogy there is obvious. A writer who's ready to write has his pen ready to put on the paper. Likewise, the psalmist's tongue is ready to speak. And he does so in verse 2. You are fairer than the sons of men, talking to the king. So the psalmist says, you are fairer than the sons of men. Grace is poured upon your lips. Now this means that the king's lips pour forth gracious words of God, speak forth words of grace. Now that leads Clark to advocate that this king being addressed by the psalmist is King Solomon, because Solomon was known for his wisdom and proverbs. But as soon as he says that, Clark says, verse 3 can't refer to Solomon because Solomon was a king of peace and would not gird on a sword. But verse 3 says, gird your sword on your thigh, O mighty one, O king. So that's pretty weak. If this is referring to the Messiah, of course, grace is poured upon Jesus' lips. No problem. Therefore, God has blessed you forever. If that's the Messiah, then the end of verse 2, therefore, God has blessed you forever, refers perfectly to the Messiah. However, if it refers to an earthly king, you have to take forever as being translated a very long time, because it often is in the Old Testament. So that word there is not dispositive of the question one way or the other. The psalmist continues in verse 3. Gird your sword on your thigh, O mighty one. The mighty one is referring to the king who's being addressed, whoever that king might be. Gird your sword on your thigh in your splendor and your majesty. Well, now, if this is talking about the Messiah, Jesus never girded a sword on his thigh. So we would have to start getting allegorical here. And so that's the weakness in the king is the Messiah case. Verse 4, the psalmist continues, and in your majesty ride on victoriously for the cause of truth and meekness and righteousness. Let your right hand teach you awesome things. The right hand, of course, is the hand of power. Now, one might ask, how can the right hand, the hand of power, teach the king awesome things? That doesn't really make sense because that's an awkward translation of the New American Standard Bible. The Holman Christian Study Bible has show. So let your right hand show you awesome things. That makes sense. Verse 5, the psalmist says of the king, your arrows are sharp, the peoples fall under you, your arrows are in the heart of the king's enemies. Well, two comments we can make about that. Notice how meekness in verse 4 is combined with adjectives and metaphors of strength and power. In your majesty, that's power. Victoriously, power. Awesome things, arrows, sword in verse 3, power. But it's all in the cause of truth and meekness. And I think that's a good thing to make an application of. A lot of times God's power has to be manifested in judgment, arrows, swords. But the purpose of his harsh judgment is to establish truth and meekness, because gentle people get killed by people with swords and arrows, and so God's got to look after them. The cause of truth, Jesus is a God of love and compassion. But in order for his cause to be established, sometimes there has to be a victorious king with swords and arrows, sharp arrows. That's the first thing I like to say about those two verses. The second thing is, if you're going to take the king here as the Messiah, the psalmist is directly referring to the Messiah. Well, when did Jesus ever have arrows? When did Jesus ever have people falling under him? When did Jesus ever have arrows shot into the heart of his enemies? Well, then you have to say all of this would be metaphorical and not literal. And of course, there are metaphors in the Bible. I understand how that could be metaphorical. That's not a slam dunk argument against the king being the Messiah in this psalm, but it does make you wonder. We go now to Psalms 45, verses 6 through 7. The psalmist continues, your throne, O God, is forever and ever. A scepter of uprightness is the scepter of your kingdom. You have loved righteousness and hated wickedness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of joy above your fellows. Now, as I said earlier, verses 6 and 7 of Psalms 45 are quoted directly in Hebrews. Hebrews 1:8 says, but of the Son he says, your throne, O God, is forever and ever, and the righteous scepter is the scepter of his kingdom. So we know that at least typologically the king being referred to in Psalm 45 is Messiah, is the Messiah. Because the New Testament tells us that in Hebrews 1:8. Now we come across another theological problem in Psalms 45. In verse 6, the psalmist says, your throne, O God, is forever and ever. Now, why was the king called God? Why was a king called God? Well, if the psalmist is referring directly to the Messiah as God, which is one of our two options for the king as we go through here, there's no problem. This is a strong argument in favor of saying that the king is the Messiah. Of course, then we have a problem of all of these literal references to the Messiah, swords, arrows, and later on we're going to see there's a wedding feast, and there are going to be noble ladies going with embroidered garments and such, which make it hard to really apply it to the Messiah, except in a very gauzy, allegorical way. But if you take that view, then you don't have any trouble with the psalmist referring to the king as, oh my God. Benson, Barnes, and Poole are three commentators who so take this reference. Well, let's look at some other options. If you don't think that the king being referred to by the psalmist is the Messiah, then option number one, the king, the earthly king, was seen as God's representative. This is the NIV Study Bible's solution. The king was ruling in God's place, and therefore we can call him God. Kyle and Delitch back this up, and they say this, and since elsewhere earthly authorities are also called the Hebrew word for God, Exodus 21:6, Exodus 22:7, etc., etc., because they are God's representatives and the bearers of his image upon earth, so the king who is celebrated in this psalm may be all the more readily styled Elohim, which is the Hebrew word for God, may be all the more readily styled Elohim when in his heavenly beauty, his irresistible doxa, or glory, and his divine holiness, he seems to the psalmist to be the perfected realization of the close relationship in which God has set David and his seed to himself. He calls him, this same Hebrew word, it's probably Elohim, but I can't read Hebrew, he calls him Elohim, just as Isaiah calls the exalted royal child whom he exultantly salutes in Psalms 9:1-6. another Hebrew word. He gives him this name because in the transparent exterior of his fair humanity, he sees the glory and holiness of God as having attained a salutary of merciful conspicuousness among men. Well, that's some very fancy language. It's just saying, basically, the king is seen as representative of God. So when the psalmist says, "Your throne, O God," he's referring to the king as representative of God. Now, closely related to that view is what I would call option number two. Civil rulers were sometimes called gods, and that's very similar to what NIV Study Bible was saying, and that's what Colin Delitzsch was saying. Opposed to that view is Elokot, the use of Elohim in Psalms 82:6, Psalms 97:7, Exodus 22:28 hardly offers a satisfactory parallel, and even in 1 Samuel 28:13, where we should render "I saw a god," hardly prepares us to find such an emphatic ascription to an earthly king. In other words, it's one thing to say that an earthly ruler is a god, a little g god, but it's quite another thing to address that ruler and say, "Oh God, your throne is forever." Backing up Elokot is Matthew Poole, who says that the word God, Elohim, when used in other places in the scripture, is always qualified, quote, is always clogged with some diminishing expression, signifying that they are only made or called gods. Interesting point. So this is score one for the king is the Messiah advocates, because it's unlikely, according to Elokot and Poole, that an earthly king would be called God in this way. In fact, if you look at the NASB and the Holman Christian Study Bible translations, it's a capital G God, not a little g God. In fact, I found 9 total translations, and I'm sure I could have found more, that translate the Elohim here as capital G God, the true God, Yahweh, whereas I only found 1 translation that translated it with a little g God, the New American Bible. So it would seem here that the majority opinion is that this king being referred to in Psalm 45 is the Messiah, not any earthly Israelite king. Now, there is another way we can avoid the problem here of an earthly king being called God, if we assume it's an earthly king, is we can look to a different translation. Elokot says that you could translate this verse, "God is your throne forever and ever," instead of "Your throne, O God, is forever and ever." You would say, "God is your throne forever and ever." In other words, you're going to be resting on God, but you're not calling the king God. Well, that's Elokot's view. Adam Clark disagrees. He says this, quote, "Some late versions of the New Testament have endeavored to avoid the evidence of this proof." In other words, the proof that the psalmist is referring directly to the Messiah and not to an earthly Israel king. "Some late versions of the New Testament have tried to avoid the problem by translating the word thus, 'God is thy throne forever and ever.' In answer to this, it may be stated that the original Hebrew cannot be consistently translated any other way than 'Thy throne, O God, is forever and to eternity.' And there are many, many translations that agree with Clark as I've looked. So, let me review our options here. Why is this king called O God? Why is he called capital G God? First option, the king was seen as God's representative. Option number two, he was a little g God that's being referred to as kings often were. Option number three, different translation, it doesn't say. It shouldn't be translated, "Oh my God." It should be translated, "God is your throne forever and ever." And option number four, the psalmist is referring directly to the Messiah as God. Now, moving on in verse 6, this throne of God is said to be forever and ever. Of course, if this is the Messiah, that means forever through eternity, at least starting when he was crucified and resurrected and the Holy Spirit came at Pentecost, that throne lasts forever and ever with no end in the future. But if it's a earthly king, forever just means for a long time, for a very long time. At the end of verse 6, the psalmist says that this king has a scepter. A scepter is a symbol of rulership, dominion, and authority. This is what kings had. They sat down on a throne and put that iron rod or that wooden rod with an iron tip, whatever it was made out of, they planted it beneath their feet, and everybody looked at that scepter and says, "This is the guy who's in charge here." This scepter is said to be an upright scepter, so the scepter is a symbol of the righteousness of the king. Verse 7, the psalmist says, "You have loved righteousness and hated wickedness. Therefore God, your God, therefore God the Father, who is your God, either the God of the king or the God of the Messiah, has anointed you with the oil of joy above your fellows. Now, how has God anointed the king? Well, anointed means to put oil on his head, so he's anointed. So this king is anointed, and of course that's what Messiah means. Anointed with an oil of joy. Why is the oil called joyous oil? Well, Jameson Fawcett and Brown suggests because oil is used in feasts and other times of solemn joy. They would anoint people's heads with oil that says, come here, brother, let me pour some oil on your head. Whee! I don't know about that. But we know that a king is anointed for his duties of office, and that's generally a time of festivity, coronation, feast, and so forth. Another option that's been mentioned is that oil is put on people's heads after a time of mourning is over. Therefore, it's now an oil of joy because mourning is over. The time of joy has come. So a lack of oil was a sign of mourning. And when the mourning is over, it's time to dress normally, put oil on your head, slick it down, a little dab will do you, and then the mourning is over. Well, I think the best thing way to look at this expression, oil of joy, it's talking about oil that is used at the anointing of a king, which is a joyous time. Now this king, having been anointed back in verse 6, is said to rule forever and ever, as I previously mentioned. I'm going to give you some verses that make it sound like David is the king that's being referred to. So we're going to put some evidence on the earthly king of Israel side here. 2 Samuel 7:16. This is the famous prophecy of Nathan to David. Your house and your kingdom shall endure before me forever. Your throne shall be established forever. Now here's a Davidic psalm in Psalm 10:16. The Lord is king forever and ever. Psalm 72:5, also written by David. Let them fear you while the sun endures, as long as the moon throughout all generations, which is like saying a long, 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 long time. Psalm 89:4, the author here is not David, but Ethan the Ezrahite. I will establish your seed forever, build up your throne to all generations. Psalm 110, verse 4, the author is David. The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever. Isaiah 9:7, there will be no end to the increase of his government or of peace. On the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and righteousness from then on and forevermore. Well, again, that's not a slam dunk argument that David is being referred to here. Again, some people say Solomon, some people say David, some people say Ahab, some people say who knows. But it definitely refers to the Messiah or the any type of David, the Messiah. If so, that forever there is not just for a long time, but forever with no gaps. David's throne cannot be said to last forever in the sense of forever with no gaps because his dynasty died out with Zedekiah, the last king of the Davidic monarchy when the Babylonians came in and took over the place, took over Jerusalem. But the Messiah is going to live forever and ever and ever, and he's going to rule forever and ever and ever. As the famous Hallelujah chorus in Handel's Messiah, he shall reign forever and ever. We go down to Psalms 45, verses 8 through 9. The psalmist continues, all your garments are fragrant with myrrh and aloes and cassia. Out of ivory palaces, stringed instruments have made you glad. King's daughters are among your noble ladies. At your right hand stands the queen in gold from Ophir. Now here, we are getting into something that sounds like what a literal king would do. Have a wedding feast with noble ladies and the queen dressed in gold. That does not sound like Jesus. Jesus never wore garments fragrant with myrrh and aloes and cassia. He never sat and listened in ivory palaces to an orchestra playing stringed instruments for him and making him glad. He never had a bunch of noble ladies come to his wedding feast. Jesus never had a queen dressed in gold standing at his right hand. So now the argument of those who say that the psalmist is directing the Messiah directly have entered into weak territory here. Of course, you can always say this is allegorical, and that's exactly what the people who say that the Messiah is directly being addressed, that's what they do. They say this is allegory. All your garments are fragrant with myrrh. Myrrh and aloes, that's the same two spices that were used by Nicodemus to embalm Jesus' body. Aha, so there's another argument that Jesus is being referred to. John 19:39, Nicodemus, who had first come to him by night, also came bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 100 pounds weight. Now, myrrh is some kind of spice. I don't really know what it is. It comes out of the bark of a tree, if I remember correctly. I don't know. After a while, it doesn't really matter anymore. Cassia is said to be cinnamon from the bark or wood of the cinnamon tree, as Adam Clark says. Easton's dictionary backs that up. Easton says that cassia was probably prepared from the peeled bark, as the Hebrew word suggests, of some kind of cinnamon. Okay, aloe, of course, is the green leaf. I've got two bottles of aloe vera up on my shelf right now, which, of course, smells very spicy and fresh, and it heals the skin. So all your garments are fragrant with all these spices. Is that referring to the dead Jesus' grave clothes? I don't think so. Out of ivory palaces, stringed instruments have made you glad. This sounds like a wedding feast that would fit with the heading to this psalm, as translated by the NASB, a wedding song, a masculine, a wedding song. So here's the wedding. Verse 9, King's daughters are among your noble ladies. The noble ladies are the wedding party, as the NIV Study Bible says, and the king's daughters are probably daughters of surrounding nations who were invited to the king's wedding party. Clark says it would be daughters of kings of surrounding nations who gave their daughters to Solomon's harem, because he thinks the king is being addressed here as Solomon. I don't. That's a very weak case. Solomon never had a sword strapped to his thigh. So we'll assume here that the king's daughters are coming from other nations to participate in the king's wedding feast. Verse 9, at your right hand stands the queen in gold from Ophir. That sounds like a literal queen to me, unless you want to allegorize it and say it's the body of Christ standing in gold from Ophir. I mean, that's really pushing the allegorical interpretation a little bit hard. Now, gold from Ophir. Ophir is famous for gold. It's some region, people are unsure where it is, but wherever it was famous for providing a lot of gold. Some people say India, Josephus said Malaysia. Some people put it at the mouth of the Indus River, which separates Pakistan and India. Easton says all of that, but Easton says that much may be said in favor of the opinion that it was somewhere in Arabia. That's where I normally take it to be. Isaiah 13:12 says this, I will make mortal man scarcer than pure gold, and mankind than the gold of Ophir. So in America we say, you've got more gold than there is in Fort Knox. Of course, there's probably no gold in Fort Knox now because we've inflated our currency to pieces. But it used to be a lot of gold in Fort Knox. I remember at one time there was a financial crisis in America, and the government actually got the military to put gold on trucks and drive it around so the public could see that there was actually gold there. There was a run on the banks at some time. I forgot when that happened. But at any rate, some of the possibilities of where the gold of Ophir is, according to the NIV Study Bible, maybe Saudi Arabia, maybe East Africa, maybe India. Who knows? Who cares? We go now to Psalms 45, 10 through 12. The psalmist continues, listen, daughter, pay attention and consider. Forget your people and your father's house, and the king will desire your beauty. Bow down to him, for he is your Lord. The daughter of Tyre, the wealthy people will seek your favor with gifts. Now in verse 10, a daughter is addressed. Listen, daughter. The question is who is speaking? Who is making the address? Well, the most logical answer to that question is the author of the psalm is speaking to the daughter. Adam Clark suggests, rather, it could be the companion ladies to the bride who have come to the king's wedding feast, the daughter being the bride of the king. And so the ladies-in-waiting say, listen, queen-to-be. Well, let's just say it's the author of the psalm that makes it easier. Now, the question is, who is this daughter? Well, that refers to the new wife of the king, the new queen, the bride-to-be. The wedding feast being described is the wedding feast mentioned back in verse 9, where the psalmist says that king's daughters are among your noble ladies. In other words, the ladies who are in the wedding, king's daughters come from other nations to be in the wedding party. At your right hand stands the queen in gold from Ophir. That's in verse 9. This is the king's wedding that we're talking about here. Now, of course, whether that king is Jesus and the bride is the bride of Christ is what's debated amongst the commentators. And if it's a earthly king that's being talked about, we don't know which earthly king it is. So in verse 10, the new queen is told to pay attention and consider. Forget your people and your father's house. Well, that's typical what a bride does. She forgets her father's house and goes and marries her new husband. Now, if this is a type of the church, then this would be saying, hey, Gentiles, hey, sinners, forget your people, forget your Gentile background and roots and family, and join yourself to Christ. In verse 11, the king will desire your beauty. Now, of course, the problem there is that the people who are being attracted to the king and the people for whom the king will hold an attraction, they're not beautiful. They're sinners. They're Gentiles. Well, you could answer that by saying in verse 11 that the king is desiring the beauty of the church after it gets redeemed and saved. Well, that makes sense if you want to take all this as antitype, take all of this as referring to the Messiah and not to an earthly Israelite king. Bow down to him, for he is your Lord. That's what the church does to Jesus for sure. That's what a Israelite queen would do to her king also. Verse 12, the daughter of Tyre, the wealthy people will seek your favor with gifts. The "your" there is referring to the daughter, the queen. It's a different daughter here in verse 12. This is the daughter of Tyre. When you talk about the daughter of a city, it means the population of a city, as in the daughter of Jerusalem. So the population of Jerusalem, the wealthy people, will seek your favor, will seek the new queen's favor with gifts. Why would they be doing that? Well, you curry favor with the king by currying favor with the queen by giving her gifts. So all of that makes sense if what is being referred to here is an earthly Israelite king. Now the question is, if it's referring to the Messiah, what is this referring to here? Well, Gill and Clark say that many commentators think that the daughter of Tyre represents the Gentile nations that come to Christ. Tyre was a wealthy city, of course. It traded all across the Mediterranean coastlands, and they were wealthy. And so, according to Gill and Clark, this population refers to the Gentile nations that are coming to Christ. Here's what Adam Clark says. At this time, Tyre was the greatest maritime and commercial city in the world. It may be here taken as representing those places which lay on the coast of the sea and carried on much traffic, such as parts of Syria, Egypt, Asia Minor, Greece, Italy, France, the British Isles, etc., which first received the gospel of Christ and were the instruments of sending it to all the other nations of the earth. Now, that's reading a lot into that expression, the daughter of Tyre. Here's what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says about that expression, daughter of Tyre. Tyre, celebrated for its great wealth, is selected to represent the richest nations, an idea confirmed by the next clause. These gifts are brought as means to conciliate the royal parties, representing the admitted subjection of the offerers. This well sets forth the exalted position of the church and her head, whose moral qualities receive the homage of the world. Well, okay, so if the references here are taken prophetically, it is obvious that they refer to Christ and his church, but what is the primary reference? Well, I've already mentioned that. Tyre is trying to get the king's favor by giving gifts to the new queen. So I think you see here, do we take this literally with one primary sense, an earthly Israelite king, or do we project it into the messianic future and make it apply to Jesus? Either way, you have trouble. If you make it apply to an earthly Israelite king, why in the world is that in the canon? But if, on the other hand, you apply it to the Messiah, you have to get so metaphorical with it and have to make so much conjecture that it doesn't seem to really apply to Jesus. You notice that I'm not taking a stand on this because I don't know the answer to it. Not yet, anyway. Now, the fact that the daughter of Tyre, the population of Tyre, is called the wealthy people. Adam Clark says that means that, quote, the most powerful and opulent empires, kingdoms, and states shall embrace Christianity. Well, this idea of the Gentile nations bringing gifts into the people of God as being symbolic of all the Gentile nations coming into the kingdom of God, it's mentioned a lot, of course, by commentators. Let's look at some representative scriptures. Psalms 72:10, which is a Davidic psalm, says this: let the kings of Tarshish and of the islands bring presents. The kings of Sheba and Seba offer gifts. So since David is typical of the Messiah and everybody's bringing gifts to David, that's the idea of all the Gentile nations coming into the kingdom as they bring gifts to Jesus. Isaiah 60 verses 5 through 9, then you will see and be radiant, and your heart will thrill and rejoice, because the abundance of the sea will be turned to you. The wealth of the nations will come to you. A multitude of camels will cover you. The young camels of Midian and Ephah, all those from Sheba will come. They will bring gold and frankincense and will bear good news of the praises of the Lord. All the flocks of Kedar will be gathered together to you. The rams of Nebaioth will minister to you. They will go up with acceptance on my altar, and I shall glorify my glorious house. Who are these who fly like a cloud and like the doves to their lattices? Surely the coastlands will wait for me, and the ships of Tarshish will come first. To bring sons from afar, their silver and their gold with them, for the name of the Lord your God and for the Holy One of Israel, because he has glorified you, Israel. It's interesting that the header for this passage in Isaiah chapter 60, the header in the Young's Literal Translation says, the glory of the church. Holman Christian Study Bible has the Lord's glory in Zion. Well, of course, Zion is a symbol of the church. Young's Literal Translation didn't even bother with the symbolism, just says it applies to the church and everything coming into the church. I think this is a good theme. I think this theme is also emphasized in Revelation. We got the heavenly Jerusalem. We got the four gates always open, facing to the four corners of the world, and the nations of the world come streaming into the New Jerusalem, which, of course, is the church. So this is a good idea. I don't know, however, if Psalms 45 is referring to that, that the daughter of Tyre, the wealthy people seeking the favor of the king's queen with gifts, refers to all the Gentile nations coming into the kingdom. I think that commentators who say that are very creative and a little bit loose, but that's just my opinion. I could be wrong. We go down to Psalms 45, verses 13 through 15. The king's daughter is all glorious within. Her clothing is interwoven with gold. She will be led to the king in embroidered work. The virgins, her companions who follow her, will be brought to you. They will be led forth with gladness and rejoicing. They will enter into the king's palace. Now, the first problem we have here, and it seems at first glance to be a big one, is in verse 13. This beautiful woman who's being brought to the queen is called the king's daughter, not the king's bride. Well, let me read you six commentators who say that this is the queen, not the king's daughter. Ellicott, Cambridge, Benson, Colin Delitch, Barnes, Pulpit. Well, I'm not going to argue with six commentators. Plus, the context is obvious. It's a queen coming in to meet her king on a wedding day. So the question is why is she called a daughter? Well, as Barnes and Benson and the Pulpit commentators say, it's because she is a daughter of a foreign king. So the first king there in verse 13, the king's daughter, should not refer to the subject of the psalm, the king that we've been debating over, but it's referring to a foreign king who has a daughter who comes to marry the king who is being praised in Psalm 45. Pulpit commentator makes the comment that if the attendants in verse 9 were king's daughters, well, then the queen logically would be a king's daughter too. Psalms 45 verse 9 says, king's daughters are among your honored women. Among the noble ladies, the honored women. Well, if the attendants in the wedding are going to be king's daughters, we would think the queen would be a king's daughter too, and I think that explains it. The New American Standard has the king's daughter with the king being capitalized. Of course, that's referring to this king who is at least the type of the Messiah. But the Holman Christian Study Bible solves that problem by translating the royal daughter. She's the daughter of a king, but not the king that we're talking about here in this psalm. Let me read that in the Holman Christian Study Bible translation, Psalms 45:13. In her chamber, the royal daughter is all glorious. Not the daughter of the capital K king, as the NASB has it. The royal daughter, because she's the daughter of a king. So that solves the problem. Now, who this foreign king is, of course, could be anybody. Adam Clark says it's the king of Egypt, who is the foreign king. He had a daughter who was Solomon's bride. And so Clark says, the capital K king that is being praised in Psalms 45 is Solomon. Again, I've said that many times. I don't believe that. I think that's a weak case. But if the capital K king that's being honored is actually Solomon, well, Solomon did marry a daughter of the king of Egypt. I don't have the quote from me. I'm going from memory, but we know that's true. Now, let's go to the antitype. If this psalm is referring mainly to Jesus as the Messiah, either directly or as an antitype, well, then this daughter is really the bride and therefore refers to the church. And Adam Clark says, quote, spiritually, the king's daughter may mean the Christian church. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, quote, it may also intimate with some allusion to the teaching of the allegory that the bride of Christ, the church, is the daughter of the great King God. So in other words, the church is the daughter of God the Father and is married to God the Son. Please, that's just too much. This is the trouble when you get into allegory. So let's just say the king's bride is all glorious within. Why within? Within the inner chamber of the king, because Eastern noble women were scarcely ever seen in public. That's why the word within is there. The Holman Christian Study Bible says, in her chamber. They put it in brackets because that's not in the original text. So their interpretation is the king's daughter is beautiful within her chamber. She's getting ready to come out to see the king. So it could be the inner chamber of the king. It could be the inner chamber of the queen. Who knows? Her clothing is interwoven with gold. She will be led to the king in embroidered work. The virgins, her companions who follow her, will be brought to you. Typical bridal scene. The virgins will be led forth with gladness and rejoicing. They will enter into the king's palace. We go now to Psalm 45, verses 16 and 17, and we will finish this psalm, which has been the most difficult to interpret of the first 45 psalms that we've covered. Verse 16, in place of your fathers will be your sons, the psalmist continues, speaking to the king. You shall make them princes in all the earth. I will cause your name to be remembered in all generations. Therefore, the peoples will give you thanks forever and ever. Well, once again, who's being addressed in place of your fathers? Whose fathers? Well, Gill says this is the Messiah. Now, Gill hates types. He always jumps straight to the anti-type. So, in place of the Messiah's fathers will be your sons. So, the way Gill would interpret that, the fathers would be the Jews. In place of the Jews, who were Jesus' earthly fathers, will be the sons of Jesus. That would refer to the spiritual progeny among the Gentiles and the converted Jews. I don't believe that. Once again, Adam Clark says, it's Solomon in place of your Solomon's fathers will be your sons. The problem is that if we're referring to Solomon's queen as Pharaoh's daughter, she never had a son by Solomon. In fact, she never had a child. Adam Clark says that. I take his word for it. So that's a problem. You can get around by the problem and says by saying that Solomon in place of your Solomon's fathers will be your sons, which come from some of his other 999 wives or however other many wives he had. That's just total speculation. I don't believe that. It could be the your in verse 16 is referring to Pharaoh's daughter being Solomon's wife. But the problem with that is Pharaoh's daughter never had any sons that replaced her fathers or Solomon's fathers. No. It just refers to the fact that whichever unnamed king of Israel this is, that he's going to have sons. When the fathers die out, the sons are going to replace the fathers. So the ancestors die, the descendants take over. That's all it means, in my humble opinion. And the king, you shall make them princes in all the earth. It could be all the land. Earth can be translated both ways. It makes sense that the king would make his sons princes in the land of Israel. Well, let's refer to the allegorical interpretation that says all this is referring to Jesus. One of my commentators said that of all the mystical speculations of this verse, of these verses, not this particular verse, but another verse, mystical interpretations, allegorical interpretations, according to such interpretations, sons would be, as Adam Clark says, quote, the children mentioned here are generally supposed to mean the apostles and their successors in the Christian ministry, founding churches all over the world, by whom the Christian name becomes a memorial through all the earth. So in the place of the Messiah's Jewish fathers will be his sons, his apostles that go out and spread the word. That's nice. I don't believe it. I don't believe it for a minute, but I know a lot of people do. Let me give you a concluding note concerning the history of interpretation of Psalms 45. Here's what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says about that. Quote, some writers have taxed their ingenuity to find in the history and fortunes of Christ and his church exact parallels for every part of this splendid allegory, not excepting its gorgeous oriental imagery. Thus, by the dresses of the king and queen are thought to be meant the eminent endowments and graces of Christ and his people. The attendant women, supposed to be concubines, are thought to represent the Gentile churches and the bride the Jewish church. Well, that's some allegorical interpretations I haven't even encountered. I mentioned that in passage to show that there's a problem when you start getting allegorical in the interpretation of Psalms 45. Well, let me summarize the basic problem of interpretation of this chapter. If the king is the Messiah, why all the talk of fine wedding garments, etc., and then the psalm becomes to be quite allegorical and it leads to problems, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown has just pointed out. So that's a problem if you're going to take the king being the Messiah, either typologically or directly. But the other problem is if you don't go that route and you take the king to be some Israelite king, why would a psalm dedicated to a normal Israelite king be put in the canon? Well, folks, I don't have an answer to that problem. Hopefully I will before I die, but I haven't got one in time for this podcast. So I will leave that problem with you to solve the best way you can, and I will prepare myself now to go to Psalms chapter 46, which we will call God is Our Fortress in our next audio. I hope you enjoyed this discussion of Psalms 45. See you next time.